This podcast is a Fork Pitch production. For curated food content and a culinary marketplace, please visit forkpitch.com.
This is Jay Berglund. Today I'll be speaking with John Taylor. John has spent his career working with leading food service companies and retailers in menu, culinary development, R&D, and implementation. He attended Wake Forest University and the Culinary Institute of America. He is recognized throughout the industry for his many contributions in concept, food, and menu along his journey. John is passionate and resolute in creating food experiences that are worth going out of your way for. Most recently, during his 15 years on the concept and food team with Panera, John chaired the food policy initiatives from 2004 to 2016 and was co-architect of designing, developing, and implementing Panera's clean food commitments, which culminated at the end of 2016. John enjoys his life in the foothills of Colorado and, among other things, is a winemaker. Hello, John. How are you today?
Hey, doing great, Jay.
Good, good. John, you had a key role in a very successful program, a food program for a company that grew exponentially. You guys had uniquely high standards for both quality and innovation. What were your goals and what do you think made your results so special?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Jay. And I think the answer is simple, but bringing it to life and sustaining it is a different story, you know, actually quite complex. You know, I think it starts with a brand's ability to create emotional connections, if you will, with its customers. And in our case, and in the food business, focus on the food experience and great taste. Some or many people, I think, forget that at the end of the day, it's a food experience.
Right.
And I also believe, because I've seen it and because I do it as a customer myself, that people will pay for great food experiences, right? Things that are worth going out of your way for. You know, I think back to maybe around 2006 or seven when David Overton of Cheesecake Factory was giving his acceptance speech at Menu Masters for a Menu Innovator Award. And he recounted that if he could do anything differently at Cheesecake Factory, it would be to inscribe in all the doorposts of his restaurants the quote, "It's all about the food." Now, maybe he was kidding, but you get the message. And I think what made Panera Bread special during my time there was we always knew who we were, why we existed, what mattered most, and what mattered least. We constantly challenged our assumptions. We were tirelessly committed to iterating and then respond to customer needs with meaningful solutions. You know, I mean, sure, there's always going to be challenging times in this business. And you've got to acknowledge that while you can't change the winds, you can always adjust your sales.
We're doing boating references today. Okay.
Not much of a boater, but I kind of
Colorado, right? City by the bay.
Yeah. You know, ultimately, Jay, I think my experience has shown me that it comes down to leadership and vision. And in the food space, it was working on delivering great taste over and over through a commitment to craft, innovation, and discovery, right? Taste ended up being the outcome. And I'd say to your listeners that great taste is never accidental. It's always intentional.
And it's all the different things you do before you get there, right?
Yeah.
So someone once referred to politics as the art of the possible. And I think that kind of describes what you do in menu development, particularly for chains. Can you walk us through some of the conflicts that you encounter and how you reconcile tensions and merging great food and great ingredients?
Absolutely. You know, first, I can't underscore enough, and hopefully I won't sound like a broken record by the end of our time together, but the food and the importance of taste as a foundational principle when you're in this business. And not just in development or culinary, but really throughout the entire organization, right? Everybody's got to be enrolled. If the operators don't understand where we're going, why we're doing what we're doing, chances are it's not going to get done really well. And I think that success in food is about doing things that are special. Quite honestly, if it isn't special, it's probably not worth doing. You know, Ron Shaich, founder, chairman, and CEO of Panera, up until the end of 2017, he always challenged our team to develop and execute fewer, more special things. One of the things he tattooed in my brain. You know, and the tension that you refer to is actually a good thing to have. It keeps the development and testing and validation and implementation process dynamic, a little bit edgy. It encourages other possibilities and perspectives. You know, I find that if you start with a list of preconceived constraints and restrictions on what you can't do or what the food can't be, maybe it's too difficult, maybe we don't have the right piece of equipment, you literally shut down the world of possibilities to create into. And, you know, Scott Davis, chief concept officer and sort of the soul of Panera, used to say in our time together, don't kid yourselves. Frozen hamburgers don't taste better. They just cost less. And,
what's the old expression? Don't negotiate against yourself, right?
Yeah. You know, I've experienced over the years, Jim, many brands that start out developing gold standards, and they're really differentiated. They're really phenomenal. But as they wiggle through the testing pipeline, they get whittled down to something that if you go back and look at what you actually started with, they almost don't resemble what was created up front. And, you know, there's enough Me Too stuff out there. We don't need more of it.
Right. The food world is fluid. And you know, you talk about doing something special, but special at times is kind of a slave to what's consumers are interested in, what's trendy, what's hot, frankly. I mean, and so when you're doing menu development, do you follow consumer trends as well as culinary trends? And how have you seen restaurants concepts adapt to the various trends that are out there?
Yeah, Jay, when I think of trends in the restaurant food space, I sort of segment them into a couple of different boxes, right? One is fads, you know, viral responses, fad diets, even concepts like cupcake shops. Now, I'm not the core customer, but I don't even know if they're out there anymore.
Yeah. Right.
The second bucket would be micro trends, kind of short-term things. Today, you know, you've seen a lot of vegetable milk, oat milk, plant-based protein, CBD and beer. You know, the jury's out. And then you have longer-term trends that actually become paradigms because people create lasting changes in their lifestyle. I went back to a Forbes article from 2012 just to see what some of the fads or the predicted trends were. And it cited lots of activity around bison, Peruvian food, and fennel pollen. I'm not sure that they would be a mega trend. You know, I'd suggest an approach that embraces timeliness over trendiness. There could be the in and out sort of thought of the moment, product of the moment, but understand the amount of resources and work and effort that it takes to execute something like that at scale. Mm-hmm. The other point I would say is, you know, in the last 20, 25 years, sometimes food service drives retail, but many times retail drives food service. So you've got to pay attention to what's happening at retail, right? Look at what kind of growth, proliferation, product assortment Whole Foods delivered and how they disrupted the conventional retail space beginning in the 90s.
I think it's a good point. The produce particularly, that people actually became exposed to certain kinds of produce from retailer, and retailers became more comfortable with eating them in restaurants.
Absolutely. You know, this past week I read an article on bioprinting lab-grown meat using lab-cultured chicken cells.
Yeah.
And it also cited some work being done in lab-grown pork belly and bacon strips. Now, I'd like to think of myself as being open to new ideas, but if I brought that up in my house, my kids would say to me, "Come on, man."
Yeah, that would take some convincing. Yeah.
Yeah. Ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. How does food conceptualization incorporate operational considerations? You talk about, you know, trying to do great with what you have from a concept perspective, but someone has to execute. So talk a little bit about how those operational considerations come into that, your process.
Yeah, Jay, the first step is, you know, if you want to be a better competitive alternative, right? If you want people to walk across the street to go to your place versus the thousands or hundreds of other choices they have, at its highest level, all attributes of food need to be secondary to taste. Now, your listeners are probably getting ready to reach out and choke me. But if it doesn't taste great, why bother doing it, right? Ask yourself what matters most, what matters least, and then let go of what matters least. So if you start with something special, from there, you've got to build out a testing or a validation process to prove it out with customers and operators, right? If it requires new equipment, the ROI and the investment hurdle just went up. But I would say don't let the investment squash a new category for growth or a phenomenal new menu item. We all know, hey, no question, at the end of the day, the food and the experience has to be executed. And I'm not the guy that's executing it. It's got to be done consistently, reliably. So at that point, you know, you have a choice to face. You can either figure out what's required to make it work, which a lot of people will walk away from because people don't, and companies don't like doing tough stuff, or you dumb it down and you end up rolling out something that's not special. One other point is, you know, clearly there's labor challenges, there's supply challenges, there's work environments. I mean, all those things aren't going away. I'm just surprised that in this country, there haven't been more developments in incorporating artificial intelligence inside of restaurant equipment, that it seems like it'd be an area of disruption and a value add to provide real solutions to tomorrow's problems today.
Would you think that maybe that all the main thrust of technology is to reduce labor costs rather than to achieve higher levels of quality?
Yeah, you know, I think there's an opportunity for those to overlap and for 1 + 1 to equal 5 instead of 2. And I think it's going to take time for us to get there. But every time that I have an audience with equipment suppliers, I'm starting to have those conversations about, and there's some pretty exciting things being done internationally, but somehow they haven't made their way here yet.
Well, building on that, how other ways has technology changed what you do?
Oh, gosh, it's changed it in a number of ways, right? I think about the speed of change, access to new information, new markets. We've got a more sophisticated food customer out in the space. You've got a really, really short disruption cycle. You know, for me, it does give me global access to ingredients, concepts, trends, sourcing from my smartphone. It, you know, positively, it raises the bar for the customer on getting the restaurant community to think about meeting the customer where and when they want it. It's clearly forced innovation and rethinking the traditional box that we operate of, especially if you're a sit-down place. What I don't too much care for is, you know, the sites like Instagram that focus on the style of food, and sometimes that seems to trump substance. You know, one bad review from somebody goes viral. But the thing that technology that I've seen is starting to change is developments in the manufacturing arena. And a really quick example of some food producers that are innovating today and producing products that are higher quality and more consistent than I could ever do at scale. There's a meat company down in Fort Worth, been around 85 years, Standard Meats. And the team there, Jay, has perfected a process at scale that literally sears and cooks whole muscle protein, you know, like a chef would employ, your son would cook at home in a high quality restaurant using time-honored techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Results in simple yet remarkable. I mean, the stuff is melting in your mouth, but it's just protein seasoning and the process, you know, no processing aids, no incidental additives.
It's seared and cooked or it's just seared?
No, seared and cooked, fully cooked. And if you opt for HPP, high pressure pasteurization, mm-hmm. the product doesn't need to be frozen, ships to the cold chain refrigerated, eliminates at the operator level having to pull thaw, or in most cases force thaw. And just a phenomenal new technology that I think we're going to continue to see more, you know, and they're not the only folks doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
That's exciting because, you know, one of the paradigms in our industry, it's funny when I talk to folks, especially those that promote, you know, made from scratch. I'm not really sure what that is.
Right.
But in today's world, I don't think it's either or, right? I don't think it's scratch made or prepared for you. I think it's both. And I think taste ought to be the final arbiter of
the result. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. What's the hardest part of menu development, John?
You know, I think it's activating and embracing a food culture of continuous improvement, right? Relentless iteration. You know, the notion that there is no best, only better. And I recall in the mid-teens here when we launched a commitment to clean up the menu before there was a blueprint, before there was a process, right? We had to figure out how to do it. You know, you take an iconic menu item at Panera Bread, like broccoli cheddar soup. And I remember Ron at the beginning of the process coming over and leaning on my shoulders as hard as he could in front of a group of people and said, don't screw up broccoli cheddar soup. And we didn't. Over a 2.5 year period of time, we iterated and continued to iterate the recipe 72 times before we came up with the final version that had the same flavor, the same texture, and actually outperformed the prior product in sensory. So
that was, you were trying to both reduce the amount of ingredients and as well as make as natural and as transparent a ingredient label as possible, correct?
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you open up your cupboards at home, Jay, and you're going to prepare a meal, you don't reach for sodium diacinate, sodium guanylate, and sodium benzoate, and all these other things that are in our food. And I understand that in some cases, when you're distributing food at scale, that there's a very real need to have those ingredients in the food supply. But we started to, and it was really an outgrowth, Jay, of watching what was happening at retail, right? Going back to one of our other earlier topics. And you looked at all the work and the awareness that was being raised on ingredient statements and nutritionals and regulatory trans fats. And we just saw this curve coming where we said, you know, the simpler the ingredients that we use in the food that we produce, quite often there's a direct correlation to how great they taste. And so we just went back in, we challenged the supply chain with our suppliers and said, why is this stuff got to be in the product? And not surprisingly, some of the first answers we got were, well, it's always been in there, right? That's the pantry that we use to develop the products. And so we pushed on that. And I think the consumer connected. They appreciated what we did in terms of transparency. We didn't screw up the taste of their items. And it was really, really well received.
You mentioned that you'll never really get to best. It's always better. You're always aiming for great. Have you seen slippage in the industry over time? And do you see general change in the pursuit of food quality?
Yeah, I think, delivered quality to the customer is probably the toughest element of the experience to master, right? And of all the brands in our space, one serves to me as the gold standard in always excelling at delivering exceptional experiences time and time again. And that's, I used to know them as Houston's. Now they've sort of morphed, and the restaurants have different names under the umbrella of the Hillstone Group. But they absolutely get it, right? The food is contemporary, it's timeless, it's simple. It may not always be edgy, but it's what I call an identifiable and not identical experience. A couple of months ago, I was having a conversation with a friend and colleague who really framed up what's happening in the marketplace today. And there's a real shift that I've noticed over the last probably 5, 6, 7 years in our business. And that's moving from great as an internal standard to good enough. And I'm convinced that the brands that will prosper and thrive will continue to pursue and iterate to great, right? Good or good enough just ain't going to cut it.
Who influenced your thinking about great food?
Yeah, I've been really blessed and privileged, Jay, to spend some time and work with some really, really remarkable folks that have transformed my thinking. You know, the first that comes to mind, Ron Shaikh, now the founder of Act Three Holdings. He tattooed in my brain, to compete, you must be special. And the only thing that I would add to that is once you lose it, you rarely, if ever, get it back. And, you know, he always preached, know what matters, challenge your assumptions, and the importance of being a better competitive alternative in a what today is a really crowded marketplace. You know, Scott Davis, now the brains and innovation and the stomach behind Core Life, he recounted an example of cracking a safe. And, you know, he said, you know, as a food developer, many or most people can always get the first tumbler to drop and the second tumbler to drop. You get to that third tumbler and it's really difficult. And I'm talking about, you know, the food quality, the specialness. And he said, but, you know, don't give up. It's not easy, but it's worth the time and the effort and the iteration to get that final fourth tumbler to drop, to open up the safe. And, you know, Scotty also used to talk about the lust factor of food. And coined the phrase, lust is still king. And it's true. I mean, maybe today we talk about lust as being craveability, but it's one and the same. You know, two other folks, one, Warren LaRuth. Don't know if you knew Warren. He had his own restaurants in New Orleans. He's the guy that actually developed the Duncan Hines cake mixes, Good Seasons Italian dressing, actually the filling for the Hostess Twinkie. But Warren taught me the importance of precision. He had incredible taste buds. He actually coined an acronym called WBIs. And he was talking with me one day and said, Warren, I don't want to sound stupid, but what are WBIs? And he said, it stands for when bitten into. And it's the experience that you go through as a customer that when you're eating a food item, there are certain flavors that you just taste ever so slightly, but they're there in the back of your mouth.
Like the concept of, like the Japanese concept of kokumi, right?
Yeah. He talked about needing to have those. What level do you want to have them in the product? But he was masterful. And I think the last guy that popped up is Bill Nyman, you know, formerly of Nyman Ranch and BN Ranch. And, you know, he taught me that it's okay to bring your humanity to work. You know, somebody that honors and embraces the natural and the universal principles in our food system, taught me a lot about the relationship between those principles and how it connects to better tasting, higher quality food, animal husbandry, sustainability, right? The overall end-to-end impact of the decisions that we make in our food system today. But he's definitely a pioneer.
Okay, well, we're about done here. Time's about up. But I want to give you the last word on what you think the intersection between great food and great experience looks like. I mean, you just mentioned New Orleans, and as wonderful as the food is in New Orleans, and I'm a huge fan. I've probably been there 30 times in my life. You almost wonder to what extent the experience of going to a place as special as New Orleans contributes to the great food. How do those two intersect?
Yeah, for me, Jay, I kind of distill it down to a couple of brands out there. Brands I would go out of my way for, I'd cross the street for. And I think it looks like what some of these brands activate day after day inside their four walls. And it's brands like, I would mention Tate, Core Life, Flower Child, Kava, Brassica, Life Alive, Snooze, True Foods Kitchen, right? All very different size and scale of operations. Some of them are really small. Some of them are much larger. But these guys, to me, they epitomize what great food and experience look like. And it's remarkable. It's really, really complicated to do that day in and day out. But they figured it out, and they're unwavering in their approach.
Thank you very much, John Taylor, and we look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thanks, Jay. Let's eat.